all picture the same thing. Words are very important. Most people don't know that, and the more specific a word is, the better it is. But is an actual penguin better than an actual monkey? Ibrahim thinks. No animal is better than any other animal. We are all just a collection of atoms smashed together, even people, even trees, even tigers. Kendrick blows out his cheeks. Even hippos? Ibrahim nods. He goes back to his crossword. What you doing? Asks Kendrick. Hopping. Is it a puzzle? A crossword puzzle, says Ibrahim. Is it boring or interesting?
A bit of both, says Ibrahim. That's why I like it.
Ron stands and stretches. I'm just going to nip down to the shop. Ibrahim, would you like an ice cream?
No, thank you, Ron, says Ibrahim.
No one wants an ice cream, rightio, says Ron and turns to go. Kendrick clamps his lips together and lets out a small noise. Ron turns back. You all right there, Kendrick? Kendrick keeps his lips together and murmurs an uncertain, Nothing you want? Some eggs? Washing up brush? Toilet cleaner? Sardines? Kendrick shakes his head. You sure?
I'm going to the shop anyway. Bottle of whiskey? A cabbage? I can get you a cabbage if you want.
Kendrick looks down. No, thank you, Grandad. Ron smiles and picks his grandson up.
Maybe an ice cream, though?
Kendrick looks at him. Really?
You're on holiday, Kenny. It ain't a holiday without an ice cream.
Were you just teasing?
I was just teasing.
Could I get a twister? I had one when I stayed at Grandad Keith's.
Grandad Keith, that old fraud. You don't buy a house that big from selling used cars, and a Millwall fan too. Also, when had Kendrick stayed at Grandad Keith's? Susie had kept that quiet. Something wasn't right with Susie and Danny.
I'll tell you what, you can have two, says Ron, and puts Kendrick down as he wriggles with delight.
I have never had two twisters before.
Out of the window, Ron sees Joyce walking with Siobhan. Poor Poppy's mum. She turned up last night. Ron knows he should be feeling nothing but sympathy for Siobhan, but really he's thinking what a good-looking woman she is. Give it a week, though, he thinks. He really wouldn't mind chancing his arm. After the funeral, maybe?
He leaves Kendrick with Ibrahim, both happy. As he slips on his coat, he can still hear Ibrahim.
What's another word for parallelogram? Seven letters.
I don't think there is another word, says Kendrick.
Maybe you're right, says Ibrahim.
Ron opens the front door and smiles. How did he end up with a grandson and a best mate like these two? Lucky fella.
Chapter 48. Patrice left this morning. There was a cab to the station, there were tears. Even the odd one or two from her. The flat feels very empty, and Chris feels empty too. Elizabeth and the gang had liked Patrice. On their way out, Joyce had whispered, "Oh, Chris, she's a dream." And Ron had given him a thumbs up and said, "Give her one from me, son." Chris is hungry. Earlier this week, he had been chopping up peppers, just like he had seen people doing on MasterChef. He had a red chili, a green chili, and a yellow chili. He has always known that you can buy them in packets of three from the supermarket. He has walked past them thousands of times in his life, mocking him with their healthiness as he made his way to the pies and pasta aisle.
He's back in work tomorrow, trying to catch Connie Johnson. There's a team down from London to help out. Chris has always fantasized about being the sort of man who might buy the red, yellow and green peppers. The sort of man who would buy broccoli or ginger or beetroot out of choice. To Chris, the fruit and veg aisle at the supermarket was where he bought bananas and, occasionally, a bag of spinach to put at the top of his basket in case he bumped into anyone he knew. People always look into your basket, don't they? Chris wanted to pretend he shopped and ate like a grown man. Slip the Kit Kats under the spinach and no one's any the wiser. Chris thinks back to the day a cashier in Tesco's was scanning his shopping. As she swiped through the chocolate, the crisps, the Diet Coke, the sausage rolls, she had looked up with a kind smile and said, "What is it, dear? A child's birthday party?" Chris has used self-service checkouts ever since. He and Patrice had gone food shopping. Patrice asked him if he ever cooked stir fries, and Chris had lied and said that he did, and Patrice said she hadn't seen a wok anywhere, so Chris had admitted that no, he didn't actually cook stir fries, but that he had always wanted to. They went to the market, not the supermarket, but the actual market, and they bought a bit of this and a bit of that. As Patrice asked a man in an apron where his raspberries were from, Chris felt like a proper human being. It was like they were a couple from an advert. Chris kept hoping people would see him. "What, this? Oh, it's just me and my girlfriend buying bean sprouts." This place was empty without Patrice. Without her falling asleep on the floor in the living room while doing an online yoga class on her laptop. It was all very good in theory to have a girlfriend who did online yoga classes, but even better to have a girlfriend who was happy to have a nap in the afternoon. Chris hadn't wanted this week to end. On Monday, Patrice will be back to school in South London. They'll be back to Skype calls and watching the same TV shows in different rooms. His heart sinks, though, at the thought of the lock-up and the thought of surveillance food. Would he go back to his old ways the moment Patrice was gone? He thinks back to last night. Chris had circled coconut oil into a wok. They had had to buy coconut oil, and they'd had to buy the wok. And, once he had completely come clean to Patrice, they had had to buy the chopping board, the sharp knives, and the sea salt and black pepper too. What a heady ride that shopping trip had been. A 51-year-old man tossing peppers and bean sprouts and spring onions and tofu, which was a whole other story, into a wok and hearing the sizzle so familiar from television. He had started to cry. Where had that come from? From the years of late-night takeaways by himself. The snacks, the numbing release of empty fat and carbs. The long nights, the long years, on his sofa with no one to put his arms around. And now this. The colours, the smells, the sheer everyday normality of it. Chris hadn't looked after anyone in a long time, and that included himself. He let the tears run down through the steam and into the pan. As the first tear sizzled, arms had encircled his waist. Patrice had woken up. He had turned and she tilted her head up to kiss him. "You have to stand back from the wok if you don't want your eyes to water." "Good tip," said Chris. "How was yoga? You get it all done?" "Hmm," says Patrice. "Intense, though." She had pushed herself up and sat on the worktop. Chris was aware that he had seen women blithely sitting on worktops in films, but he didn't think it was ever something that would happen in his own kitchen. This lovely, sleepy woman, perched on his worktop, happy to be there. "So have you fallen in love with me yet?" Patrice had said with a laugh. "Of course," said Chris. smiling, and gave her a kiss.
I should hope so too, said Patrice, and hopped down from the worktop.
I'll get Bowles. Chris had turned back to the wok. He angled his head away from Patrice, now busily rooting through a cupboard. The tears came again then, heavier this time. What was wrong with him? It was just a stir-fry, Chris. It was just a stir-fry and a woman sitting on a worktop. It was then he realized. Realized? Understood? It doesn't matter which. It only mattered that in the instant he knew that, yes, he had fallen in love with her. Oh, God, yes. And, oh, God, no. At some point, would he really have to tell Patrice? Perhaps she could just work it out. Chris had wiped a tear from the corner of his eye. The pain from a stray chili flake on his finger was immediate, and all thoughts of love and happiness and shame and vulnerability and fear and excitement had to take second place for the moment. At least he didn't have to explain why he was crying anymore. Being healthy was easy when Patrice was here. It seemed so simple. Eat fruit, drink slimline tonic, don't have a KFC. But the evenings were longer when she wasn't here. And Chris Hudson wasn't about to steam broccoli for himself, that seemed weird. Was it okay to have a biscuit? If it was just one biscuit? Perhaps he could have some chocolate if it was just that dark chocolate you could buy in health food shops. It tasted awful, so surely that made it okay. Ibrahim had once told him that walnuts were very good for you, so now Chris is eating a lot of walnuts. Where to draw the line? Everywhere delivered now, not just the restaurants, that was bad enough, but the local shops. Chris could have Pringles and an Aero brought to his door within 10 minutes. He eats another handful of walnuts, chewing begrudgingly. Perhaps he would have a herbal tea, or just order a Twix. What harm would that do? Or two Twixes, because they were so small. Maybe a curry, but with a vegetable side dish instead of poppadoms. Stop thinking about food, Chris. Think about work. Ryan Baird's hearing is coming up. That should be an easy win. Think about Connie Johnson. Has she made any mistakes? He doesn't like the thought of her being driven around Fairhaven in that Range Rover like she owns the place. Chris's entry phone starts to ring. 9:45. Late for a visitor. Chapter 49. Strictly speaking, it is not a date. She and a DCI from London had been on surveillance all evening, keeping an eye on Connie Johnson's lockup. Donna would rather have been on the stakeout with Chris, and now her mum has gone back to South London, she'll get her wish soon enough. There was nothing to report at the lockup. A few lads on bikes coming and going, no new faces, no Connie. Donna had half expected to see Ryan Baird cycling up to the door at some point, but perhaps he is lying low until his court appearance. Connie had their number, that was for sure. But if she and Chris could find a way of nailing her, then medals and promotions would surely follow. The DCI was one of a crew down from London for a couple of weeks. Connie Johnson was being taken seriously and reinforcements had been brought in. He is currently sitting opposite her drinking beer from the bottle. I don't need a glass, it's already in glass. He was the only single man in the whole bunch, if Donna's extensive Facebook investigations were to be believed. The DCI is called Jordan, or maybe Jaden. With desserts on the way, it was probably too late to ask which now. She has just been calling him Sir all evening, and he doesn't seem to mind. So far, she has found out that he has never watched Bake Off because it's mind-numbing rubbish, but nevertheless, he thinks that 5G phone masts are a government conspiracy and something to do with cancer. Something we should be keeping an eye on at the very least. He must be 35 or 40, it's so hard to tell with men at that age. He looks like he has strong arms, and that was enough for Donna to agree to dinner at Le Pont Noir after their shift. God, she is lonely. She is nearly 30, with friends pairing off and disappearing. Carl, her ex, was engaged already. He'd wasted no time. And this, a man who needed space and wasn't ready for commitment, babe. His fiancée is a shoe influencer rather than a police officer, and they are getting married in Dubai. So Donna is the new girl in a new town. A black girl in a seaside town where she feels unwelcome or a novelty and has no interest in feeling either. Where are you from, then? South London. No, where are you really from? Oh, I see. I'm really from Streatham. A town where Boots doesn't have your shade of foundation and the nearest person you can trust with your hair is in Brighton. None of this will kill her, but none of it helps her feel any less lonely. But you have to make the best of things, and you also have to hang out with people under 50 every now and again. Hence this too obvious man, whatever he might actually be called. Best foot forward, Donna. I can't believe you haven't caught her yet, says the DCI with the possibly strong arms. Connie's smart, says Donna. Smart for a small town, I suppose, says the DCI. Not smart for London. Lucky for you, lot, me and the cavalry have arrived. You haven't caught her either, says Donna. Not unreasonably, she thinks. London has different rhythms, love, a different heartbeat. I know, says Donna. I'm from London. You have to live it, really. You breathe it in, the big bad city. As I say, I was born there. Where are you from? High Wycombe, says the DCI. The mean streets, says Donna. Is that a joke? Asks the DCI. No, it's just conversation, says Donna. You can join in. Does he have nice eyes? Well, they're a nice colour, that's something. I'm staying at the Travel Lodge, by the way, says the DCI, looking at his watch, a fake Rolex, no doubt borrowed from an evidence store. Donna nods. So she is going to have sex in a Travel Lodge this evening if she doesn't want to be alone. So be it. Let's get the bill, get a bottle of wine on the way, and get it over with. A bit of oblivion while her mum and her boss are falling in love. You're governor, then, says the DCI, Chris Hudson. He seems a bit hopeless. I wouldn't underestimate him if I were you, says Donna. Be very careful now, Jordan or Jaden. He wouldn't last a second in London, says the DCI. Would he not? Asked Donna. No, he couldn't catch COVID, that one. Well, there it was. Donna wasn't going to have disappointing sex in a Travel Lodge this evening after all. Wasn't going to boost the ego of this nondescript man. What was she even doing here? What was she looking for? The waiter brings over the bill and the mediocre DCI, who just made the mistake of insulting her best friend, takes a look. You okay going halves? Asked the DCI. Also, you had wine, so... Of course, sir, says Donna, reaching for her bag. She is going to do something about her life. In fact, she knows just the man she should talk to. Ibrahim. She's just sent him the CCTV from the station. Would he mind if she came to see him sometime? Donna doesn't need therapy, but she wouldn't mind a nice long chat with a friend who happens to be a therapist. Her phone pings. It's a message from Chris. Chapter 50.
Chris Hudson pads over to the handset on the wall and picks it up. Hello? Perhaps it's Donna on her way home from a disastrous date with an ice cream salesman. Hi, Chris, it's me, says a disembodied female voice. Not Donna. Okay, says Chris. Any other clues? The voice on the phone laughs. I told you I knew where you lived, silly. Chris freezes. Connie Johnson. Are you going to let me up? I have something to discuss with you. Won't take long. Chris curses beneath his breath and buzzes her in. What is this going to be? He quickly types out a text message to Donna. Connie Johnson at flat. If I don't ring in 15 minutes, send squad car. Chris looks round to see if the flat is in any way presentable, and of course it is, because he'd made it presentable for Patrice and hasn't had enough time to ruin it yet. There is a knock at the door. Chris takes a deep breath and opens it. Hello, Chris, says Connie Johnson. Chris refuses to respond but ushers her in. Well, this is nice, isn't it? Says Connie, surveying the flat. Small, but nice. Well, it's all I can afford without selling cocaine to children, says Chris. All right, Mother Teresa, says Connie and sits on Chris's sofa. Chris takes a dining chair, places it opposite her and sits. You know you're on thin ice, says Chris, coming round to a police officer's home. Says Connie. You're probably on thin ice inviting me up. Do you have anything to drink? No, says Chris, which is actually pretty much the truth. Be like that then, says Connie. I'll just get straight to it. What do you know? About you? Yup, says Connie. I know you killed the Antonios. I know you've got a Range Rover. I know you're clever, but not quite clever enough to get away with what you're doing, so I'll just keep plodding on. Says Connie again. Well, firstly, no comment, and secondly, I think you're pretty smart too. That's what people say. I'm not smart, says Chris. I'm smarter than you, but I'm not smart. Connie nods. Maybe. It was certainly easy to find out where you lived. Chris shrugs. It's quite easy to follow someone home, Connie. It is, agrees Connie. It was easy to follow you here, and it was easy to follow Donna de Freitas to 19 Barnaby Street too. She's on a date tonight, by the way, Pont Noir. Chris laughs. This isn't the school playground. We're Fairhaven police officers. We live in Fairhaven. It's pretty easy to track us down. But if you're trying to scare me, try harder. You wouldn't touch a police officer, and you know it. I do, says Connie. So what do you want? Well, nothing really. I just wanted to say that as a businesswoman, there's a limit to how much I'm going to tolerate you poking into my affairs. Is there? There is. Taking photographs of my customers and so on. I'm approaching my limit now, so just between friends, I'm telling you to tread very carefully. Chris nods. Sure. Because you know my address and you know Donna's address. Terrifying. It's just a friendly warning, says Connie, pushing herself up off the sofa. If you're not worried, you can just ignore it. I will, thanks, says Chris, showing her to the door. Sorry I called so late, says Connie. I keep funny hours. She's gorgeous, by the way. Chris had been about to shut the door behind her, but has stopped in his tracks. Connie laughs. You've done very well for yourself, if you don't mind me saying. I bet you're missing her already, you here and her up in South London. Don't even think about this, Connie, says Chris. Think about what? Asks Connie. Just saying, Streatham's a long way away, eh? Connie, I'm not kidding. You're not smart enough to pull this off. Let it go. I might not be smart enough, smiles Connie. But I'm quite dangerous. Or unpredictable, that's the nicest way of putting it. I followed you home, but someone else followed Patrice home for me. Get out, says Chris. I'm already out, silly, says Connie.
I promise we'll keep an eye on her for you, make sure she's not up to mischief. She's really very pretty. Bet she keeps you on your toes, like all the best women. As Connie blows him a kiss, Chris slams the door and slumps back against it. Think quickly. Assess the risk. Tell Patrice that Connie has just threatened her. Ask her to be careful. Look out for Range Rovers. Terrify her. For what? For some amateurish bluff. Jesus. Was it a bluff? Just how unpredictable was Connie Johnson? Could he... Chris's phone rings. Donna. His 15 minutes are up. He knows he has to pick up. All clear, he says. What did she want? Asked Donna. Tell Donna the truth. Chris makes an instant decision. He hopes it's the right one. She just wanted to threaten me. And you. Just letting me know she had our addresses, telling us to ease off. Donna laughs. She thinks we'll be scared of her. I laughed her off too. Told her to do her worst. And that's all? Asked Donna. Just some amateur intimidation? Yup. Sorry if I worried you. Don't be silly. Are you okay? You want me to pop over? We could watch another episode of Ozark. Chris opens a kitchen drawer and looks at the takeaway menus neatly tidied away by Patrice. No, I should get some sleep. You had a good evening? Surveillance with that guy from the Met. Jaden? Jordan? Jonathan, says Chris. I'll see you in the morning. Night, Skipper, says Donna. Chris looks at the menus again. He would kill for a curry. He slams the drawer shut. If you don't love yourself, who's going to love you? Chapter 51. Ibrahim is propped up in bed. He has a cigar and a glass of brandy on his bedside table and his laptop open in front of him. He clicks on the CCTV file Donna has sent him. You will go a long way to find someone else in Cooper's Chase who knows as much as Ibrahim about IT. A long way. Now, I need you to listen carefully, says Ibrahim. Douglas and Poppy were murdered sometime before 5 p.m. on the 26th, so we need only to watch the footage from then until Elizabeth and Joyce check the locker on Thursday. Just the next 3 days or so. Okay, says Kendrick and leans his head on Ibrahim's shoulder. Why don't I look through the 26th on my laptop and you look through the 27th on your iPad? Brilliant, says Kendrick. And if you see anyone trying to open locker 531, then just shout. Okay, says Kendrick. Well, I won't shout, I'll just tell you. That's a good plan, agrees Ibrahim. And let's talk while we're watching. So we don't get bored, says Kendrick. Exactly, says Ibrahim, and presses play on the CCTV footage. The fastest he can play it is at 8x speed. The facility opens at 7 a.m. and shuts at 7 p.m, so it will take him 90 minutes to get through the day. With Kendrick, he can cover 2 days in that time. Perhaps it's not the perfect job for an 8-year-old, but children were far too mollycoddled these days. I'm watching mine now, says Kendrick. What shall we talk about? Ibrahim is looking at the black and white feed on his screen. The camera shows the whole aisle of lockers. Even at 8x speed, not a soul has come or gone yet. How is school? It's okay, says Kendrick. Do you know Romans? I do, says Ibrahim. A backpacker has just stuffed her bag in a locker further down the aisle. Who's your best? Asks Kendrick. My best Roman? Mine is Brutus. There was just a cleaner, but she didn't steal anything. I think I like
Seneca the Younger, says Ibrahim. He was the greatest of the Stoic philosophers. He was very good on the theory of the whole thing, but also always looked to give practical advice. He believed philosophy was not a sacred text, but a medicine.
Oh, great, we haven't done him, says Kendrick. What's the best dinosaur? Stegosaurus.
Yes, we agree there, Kendrick, says Ibrahim, and takes a swig of brandy.
Does it hurt where they kicked you?
Asks Kendrick, his eyes still clearly glued to the CCTV. I tell the others it doesn't, says Ibrahim, but it does. Very much.
They probably know, says Kendrick.
They probably do, says Ibrahim. But you're the only person I'm telling for sure.
Thanks, Uncle Ibrahim, says Kendrick. Someone just took a box out of one of the other lockers, but just boring. Did you feel it when they kicked you? Were you frightened?
Those are very good questions, says Ibrahim, as a man in a suit puts his briefcase in a locker, then takes off his tie and puts that in too. Lost his job and hasn't told his wife yet. I remember being very scared, and I remember feeling like I was in a washing machine. That's silly, isn't it?
Not really, says Kendrick, if that's what you felt.
And I knew I might die, I remember that. And I thought about that, and I thought it was okay. But perhaps unfair that this was how it was going to happen. And I thought, I wish I'd known.
Uh-huh,
says Kendrick. And I thought about your granddad, and I thought about Joyce and Elizabeth too, and I knew I would miss them, and I knew they would miss me, and I thought, I hope I don't die. I hope this ends up okay.
I'm happy that you didn't die, because then we wouldn't be doing this.
Ibrahim lights his cigar.
If I was being killed, I would think of Grandad too. And now I would think of you. And I would think about Cody at school and Melissa and also Miss Warren. And I would think mainly about my mum.
Wow, that's a big cigarette.
You shouldn't smoke, did you know that?
Ibrahim takes a puff. Mostly I do what I'm told. Life is easier that way, but sometimes I don't do what I'm told.
Like me, says Kendrick. Sometimes I stay awake, but Mum doesn't know.
You wouldn't think about your dad, asks Ibrahim, if you were being killed? Kendrick considers this for a moment.
I think maybe he'd be angry about it.
Ibrahim nods and tucks this away. I didn't think about my dad either.
You don't have a dad, Uncle Ibrahim. He would be 1,000.
The boys settle to their work for a while. Ibrahim sees 7 or 8 people walking up the aisle, always to other lockers, and Kendrick sees about the same. No one has yet touched locker 531. The occasional conversation is very easy, and Ibrahim discovers that Kendrick's favourite number is 13, because he feels sorry for it, and Kendrick sets him a quiz about the planets. Biggest, Jupiter. Best, Saturn. Not Earth. You can't count Earth. The clock on the screen ticks on, 8 times faster than the clock on his bedside table. Another cleaner comes in at the end of the day, and they are done.
That was so good, says Kendrick. Can we do the other day together now?
Ibrahim agrees that they can. He receives a text from Elizabeth. Any news? And he replies, yes, I am concerned about Kendrick's relationship with his father. Elizabeth replies back with a rolling eyes emoji. She has really taken to emojis.
After a toilet break, considerably quicker for Kendrick than for Ibrahim, they settle down for the footage from the day Elizabeth and Joyce opened the locker, and so they will stop as soon as they see them. The fast-forwarded black-and-white images zoom by once again. Neither Ibrahim nor Kendrick tires, because who tires when they are having fun? Ibrahim asks if Kendrick likes books, and Kendrick says he likes some of them, but not others. And Kendrick asks if Ibrahim ever lived in another country, and Ibrahim replies Egypt, and Kendrick spells it for him. Ibrahim is looking at the video when, around lunchtime, he sees Elizabeth and Joyce and slows the footage down to normal speed. He can't hear what they are saying, but you can always pretty much guess with those two. He sees them having trouble opening the locker, sees Joyce go into her bag, then sees Elizabeth try again and the locker door pops open. The picture quality is not great, but you can make most things out. Elizabeth takes out the crisp packet, the one she showed Ibrahim this morning, then Joyce puts it in her bag and they leave. Kendrick wants to see the footage of Joyce and Elizabeth and says, "Oh my goodness, it's really them," when he does. But they find nothing else and admit defeat. So no one had visited the locker? No one had tried to open it until Elizabeth and Joyce arrived. "I wish we'd seen a baddie," says Kendrick.
"Me too," says Ibrahim.
"Elizabeth won't be pleased."
"Let's do the day before," says Kendrick. "Just for fun and in case."
Ibrahim agrees, because the moment this task is over, Kendrick will be heading back to his grandfather's. They watch the footage from the 25th, the day before Poppy and Douglas were murdered. Or just Poppy, if you believe Elizabeth. Had Douglas really faked his own death? They are a little quieter this time, both comfortable in the silence. Kendrick makes Ibrahim guess how fast a rocket is, but that's about it. As they are watching together, they both see the figure at the same time, walking down the aisle like the 100 or so others they must have seen before. But this figure is wearing motorcycle leathers and a closed helmet. And this figure stops dead in front of locker 531.
"What have we here, Kendrick?" says Ibrahim.
"Maybe a baddie," says Kendrick.
"Maybe a baddie," agrees Ibrahim, and takes another puff on his cigar. Who needs the outside world?
Chapter 52. Lance James settles into a huge white sofa next to Sue Reardon. The whole house smells of white fig and pomegranate. He knows that smell well. Or used to before Ruth moved out, taking her candles with her. He will sometimes light a match after he has been to the bathroom, but that's as new age as Lance gets.
"Do you have a cleaner, Mr. Lomax?" Sue Reardon asks.
"A white sofa is a very bold choice."
"A woman from the village has done it for years," says Martin Lomax. "Marjorie or Maggie, something like that. Thank you so much for popping in. I don't like to travel. I get car sick."
"It's not a problem at all. Lance was only at the bottom of your drive taking photos," says Sue, "and I'm not busy, just investigating the deaths of a couple of colleagues."
"Investigating?" says Martin Lomax. "I assumed you killed them."
"Did you not?"
"Believe it or not, no, we didn't. We assumed that you killed them," says Lance.
Martin Lomax juts out a lip and nods.
"Well, we can't both be right. They're dead, though, that's the main thing."
"Yes, that's some common ground," agrees Sue.
"How does it work with you having a cleaner?"
Aren't you worried she'll stumble across something? I always tidy up before she comes round, don't you?
Well, I'll tidy up some magazines and do the washing up, says Sue.
I'm like that too, always hurrying around half an hour before she arrives. I've always left something out, a brick of cocaine or some such. I've got so lazy with tidying up my things over the years. Hence leaving the diamonds lying about, of course, chides Sue.
Well, quite, agrees Lomax. Anyway, then I put Radio 4 on for her and away she goes.
How many people have you killed, do you think?
8 or 9, says Sue.
You?
Same, pretty much, says Martin Lomax.
Lance looks around. They are in a conservatory with beautiful views of the gardens. There is some stray bunting hanging from a eucalyptus tree. They must have had an event. Martin Lomax has yet to offer them a coffee or even a glass of water. It doesn't seem to be a power play. It just seems not to have occurred to him.
I know this is boring, says Lomax, and I know I bang on about it, but I really do need to find those diamonds.
Likewise, says Sue.
Well, you don't really need to find them, do you?
I'm afraid we do, says Lance.
Not really, though. Obviously, you'd look good if you found them. Obviously, people would be pleased with you. But they're not your diamonds, Sue, are they?
Well, they're not yours either, are they? Says Sue.
I read a book once where the mafia had somebody ripped apart by tigers, says Lomax, at a private zoo. Can you imagine?
Well, I'm afraid we don't have the diamonds, says Sue, and we have no idea where they are.
Rats, says Martin Lomax.
In my head, you killed them. Some big cover-up.
You hear about it with your gang, don't you?
Tortured the information out of them.
We didn't, says Lance.
Can you not just give Frank Andrade his £20 million? Says Sue.
Just give him cash and call it quits.
My assets tend to be illiquid, and they also tend to belong to someone else.
I could steal from the Mexicans to pay the mafia, then steal from the Serbians to pay the Mexicans. I'd be the old lady who swallowed the fly, and where would that leave me?
Dead, of course, says Sue Reardon.
Chapter 53. The gang are all crowded around Ibrahim's bed. Elizabeth has brought a notebook, Joyce has brought chocolate fingers, and Ron has brought a copy of Rocky 3, the best Rocky, for Ibrahim to watch with him later. But there is another film for them to watch first. Elizabeth is drumming her fingers and Ron is pacing as Ibrahim gets everything ready. He gets the footage up on his screen. Kendrick is on the balcony playing Pokemon.
So, says Ibrahim, here is today's question. Who is this?
Ibrahim presses play and they all watch as the figure in the motorcycle helmet walks down the row of lockers and stops in front of 531. The figure inserts a key.
Looks like he's having trouble with the lock too, says Joyce.
Or she, says Ron.
Ibrahim notes that Ron is getting much sharper on his gender neutrality. The figure has trouble with the lock, but eventually it pops open. The camera angle doesn't show the inside of the locker, but they know precisely what the figure is seeing. They watch as the biker takes the crisp packet out of the locker, then tosses it back in. The biker stares at the empty locker for quite some time before locking it back up and leaving. Ibrahim stops the footage and it becomes a still image.
And there we have it, he says.
So this was the day before Poppy and Douglas were shot, says Joyce.
Yes. We weren't even going to check the day before. Kendrick suggested it.
Kendrick? Says Elizabeth.
Yes, Ron's idea, says Ibrahim.
Thought he might enjoy it, says Ron.
If this was the day before, then how did somebody else know about Locker 531? Asks Elizabeth.
Douglas must have told somebody else, says Joyce.
Douglas probably told everyone, says Ron. All his ex-wives, stuck it on Facebook.
Unless it is Douglas, says Joyce. I mean, it could be, couldn't it?
It could be anyone, Joyce, says Ron. It could be Elizabeth, for all we know.
Douglas was in protective custody the whole time. It couldn't possibly be him, says Elizabeth. And besides, he was the one person who knew the locker was empty.
But who else would he have told? Asks Joyce.
They stare at the figure on the screen. Dark leathers, dark helmet, dark gloves.
What are we missing? Asks Elizabeth.
Let's watch again. They sit through the footage again. And again. And again. But nothing. Elizabeth slumps back.
We can't tell the gender, we can't tell the age, we can't even tell the height because of the angle of the camera.
That was really good orange squash, Uncle Ibrahim. Did you all see the clue?
The clue? Asks Elizabeth.
Hello, Elizabeth, says Kendrick.
Yeah, did you see it? I bet you did.
I mean, I read certain things into posture and into stride patterns, if that's...
No! The clue. Did you see it, Joyce?
I didn't spot a thing, says Joyce.
We made cupcakes earlier. I did the icing, says Kendrick. Would you like one?
No, you have mine, says Joyce.
OK, says Kendrick.
Grandad and Uncle Ibrahim, I bet you saw it.
I saw it, says Ron. But in case it's not the same clue you saw...
Why don't you say yours first?
Kendrick leans forward into the screen.
OK. Watch the bit where he's opening the locker.
Ibrahim speeds the footage through and pauses it. The four of them are all looking at each other. Ron shakes his head a little and shrugs.
You see when he reaches up to the lock, says Kendrick.
They do see.
And you see a little gap between his jacket and his glove?
They lean forward. There is a gap as the jacket slides down towards the elbow.
And there's the clue.
The short-sighted lean further forward and the long-sighted lean further back.
What is it, dear? Asks Elizabeth.
He's wearing one of Joyce's friendship bracelets.
Coiled around the wrist of the figure opening locker 531 are some inexpertly woven strands of wool studded with sequins. Everyone in the room looks down at their wrists and then at Joyce. Joyce looks down at her bracelet, then back up at her friends.
Well, that narrows things down nicely.
Chapter 54. Joyce.
You will never guess what.
Kendrick had been looking at the security footage from the left luggage office. This is Ron and Ibrahim's idea of an appropriate project for an eight-year-old. Anyway, he spotted that the figure in the motorcycle helmet was wearing one of my friendship bracelets. You really could tell it was one of mine. I don't think anybody else makes them quite like me. You can imagine the fun we had next.
Who was our biker?
Ibrahim made a list on his computer of all the people I had given friendship bracelets to. No one from the mafia, for starters, so that was Ron out of the water.
He came up with an elaborate scenario in which I had been seduced by an elderly Italian-American on the minibus, and we all had a good giggle. Chance would be a fine thing. You can see he's disappointed, though. The four of us were on the list, of course, and Kendrick. Imagine if it was Kendrick. In a book, it would be. Wouldn't it be fun to be in a book? I bet my hip wouldn't hurt so much in a book. Then, a few more interesting names. Sue Reardon has a bracelet. Could it have been her? Mike Douglas have told her where he had left the diamonds. Elizabeth says she would have taken the crisp packet, though. Lance. Less likely that Douglas might have told him, but more likely he'd have missed the crisp packet. Siobhan, Poppy's mum, has one. Had Douglas told Poppy? And Poppy told her mum? Siobhan seems very quiet and unassuming, but don't we all? Martin Lomax. But I didn't give him a bracelet until after the CCTV was taken. Also, I know I'm not one to blow my own trumpet, but I am fairly sure his went in the bin the moment we left. I did pay in his £5 cheque to Living with Dementia, by the way. Even the woman at the bank looked like she hadn't seen a cheque for years. So who else? A few people from around the village. Colin Clements, Gordon Playfair, Jane from Larkin, who is having an affair with Jeff Weeks, and don't we all know it? In fact, she gave hers to Jeff Weeks, so I suppose we have to count him too. And then Bogdan, of course. I nearly forgot him. We talked for an hour or so. Who, why, when, what? Then Mark arrived in his taxi, time for Kendrick to go home. We had a big cuddle. Ibrahim fell asleep. He's still not at his best, so Elizabeth and I left. Ron said he'd be back to watch his film once he'd dropped Kendrick off. Now, here's the thing, just between you and me. The moment I said goodbye to Elizabeth, I had a thought about how to identify the biker for certain. I was going to call after her, but I thought, no, Joyce, for once in your life, why not fly solo? You don't always need Elizabeth. And so this morning, I took the minibus down to Fairhaven. I did the same walk along the same streets to Fairhaven Station. A bit slower than last time because Elizabeth is a strider. I know she doesn't mean to be, but she is. I made straight for the left luggage office and, as I'd hoped, the nice girl with the hair and the headphones was on duty. She even recognised me, which made my day. No one ever recognises me. She took off her pretend headphones and I asked her how she was and she said she was fine, thank you. And I asked her if she was still having trouble with the manager of Costa, and she said that if anything, it was getting worse, and he had even offered her a lift home on his motorbike. I told her that for what it was worth, my experience of men with motorbikes was really very poor, and we laughed like the women of the world neither of us really is. She asked if I needed something from my locker, and I told her I needed something from her, and that it was funny we were talking about motorcycles, and that got her attention. You see, the thought I'd had when I left Elizabeth last night was that the girl at the left luggage desk took her job seriously and did it properly. I thought there was no way she'd let someone walk into the locker area willy-nilly wearing a motorcycle helmet. And it turns out I was right. She apologised that she didn't remember the day in question, her job is quite boring, the way she was telling it, but confirmed that she would never let anybody into the lockers without seeing a key and without seeing a face. So anyone wearing a helmet would have to take it off. I asked if there was CCTV in the desk area, and she said there was because her predecessor had been fired for watching pornography on his laptop while he was working. She said she didn't blame him, as the days can start to drag.
I thanked her, and she asked what it was all about, and I said I couldn't tell her because it was government business. Well, the look on her face. Imagine me saying that if Elizabeth was there, though I don't think so. I should do more things by myself. Then I made the same trip we did last time through the streets to Fairhaven Police Station to tell Donna about the CCTV. Of course, I forget that Elizabeth always seems to know when Donna is on duty, and Donna wasn't there. So perhaps I shouldn't do more things by myself. It is a tightrope. When I got home, I told Elizabeth what I had done, and she was delighted by my ingenuity, but also annoyed that she hadn't thought of it. "Why didn't you tell me, Joyce?" she said, and I said that I'd only thought of it on the minibus. Then she told me I was a terrible liar, which of course I am. I promised her I wouldn't do things by myself in future, but she told me never to make a promise I couldn't keep. Elizabeth has sent Donna a message about the CCTV, so perhaps we shall soon find out who opened the locker. And presumably that might tell us who killed Douglas and Poppy.
Chapter 55. Cooper's Chase looks beautiful in the late autumn sun. As Donna walks up towards the village, a llama tilts a quizzical head towards her over a white fence. Donna nods a good morning to it. On the lake to her right, a goose misjudges a landing, inelegantly belly flopping into the water. She swears the goose looks round to make sure none of the other geese were watching. Up ahead, a woman with a cane sits on a bench, her face raised to the sun. Donna wonders if the woman might be lonely, until a man in a Panama hat sits down next to her with sandwiches and two newspapers. The Daily Mail for him, the Guardian for her. How had they made that work over the years, she wonders. The heart wants what it wants, of course. She passes another couple, hand in hand, and they both smile and wish her a good morning. They are walking down the path to sit by the lake. When will Donna get to walk down a path, hand in hand, and sit by a lake? The path broadens out as it reaches the village, the first building being Willows, the nursing home. Last time she had visited had been when Elizabeth took her to meet Penny, former cop and Elizabeth's best friend. No longer there, of course. Some other poor soul in her bed. Would Elizabeth be in there one day? Would Joyce? Would Ron? Surely not Ibrahim. The thought of any of them so diminished upsets her, and Donna keeps walking past Willows with her head down. Ibrahim's block lies ahead to her left, through a pretty garden still bursting with colour. A lady using a walking frame moves to one side to let her through and says, "Cheer up, my darling, it might never happen." Donna gives her a small smile in return. It might never happen. Well, yes, wasn't that just the problem? Walking up the stairs, Donna wonders again what she is doing here. Everybody goes through tough times, don't they? Everyone feels low. They don't go bleating all their troubles to a psychiatrist, do they? Not where she's from. You don't have psychiatrists in Streatham. You have mates with shoulders to cry on, to tell you to pull yourself together. But Donna doesn't have mates in Fairhaven, and so here she is. Ibrahim's door is open as Donna reaches the top of the stairs. The man himself moves gingerly and is able to give her only the gentlest of hugs. Sit down," says Donna. Ibrahim braces himself against the arms of his chair and manoeuvres himself with awkward grace into it. Donna settles herself opposite him in a beaten-up armchair beneath a painting of a boat. Just a regular police officer paying a regular visit to a friend who just happens to be a psychiatrist. She won't say anything, though. It feels silly now she's actually here. They can just look at the CCTV. She's okay, just a bit down. Nice to see you out of bed, says Donna. How's the pain?
It's getting better, says Ibrahim. It only really hurts if I breathe.
Donna smiles. Shall we take a look at this CCTV? I thought you might enjoy it.
Ibrahim nods. In good time, in good time. But first, how is your pain, Donna?
How's my pain? Asks Donna with a laugh. Oh, okay, is this how it's going to work? Is this how therapy starts?
Yes, says Ibrahim, tilting his head to one side, reminding Donna of the llama. How is your pain?
I hurt my wrist in the gym, but that's the best I've got, says Donna.
She shouldn't be here, wasting Ibrahim's time.
Is that so? Asks Ibrahim. Well, it's more of an observation than a question. Donna sees that Ibrahim has a large writing pad on the table beside his chair. He reaches over for it and takes a pen from his shirt pocket.
Okay. I have no interest in putting words in your mouth, Donna, says Ibrahim. But you really could have just looked at this new CCTV by yourself, or sent it to me, or arranged to meet all of us, but you asked to see me alone.
I wanted to see how you are, says Donna.
That's very kind of you, says Ibrahim, which is not unexpected because you are a very kind woman. As luck would have it, I wanted to see how you are, too. So how about we have a little chat and we see how we both are?
She can't fool Ibrahim, so here we go. She is now Gwyneth Paltrow or something. Donna sits back in the beaten-up old armchair, nods and closes her eyes.
Okay. It's not really therapy, is it, if you're just talking to a friend?
Ibrahim looks down at his watch. Where do you want to start?
Leaving London? Your mum and Chris?
Donna tips her head back and breathes in deeply through her nose.
Perhaps we should start with loneliness, suggests Ibrahim.